Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I was thinking we should do something big to end each show, like maybe a huge stage prop or something.
Yeah, okay. But we absolutely should not do what the Beastie Boys did.
Yeah, that would be sabotage.
All right, Patrick, welcome back. We haven't heard from you in a little while.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Tan, rested, and ready, as they used to say about former President Nixon. So think of me when you think of him.
Oh, really? Oh. I guess somebody better than that. Well, think of that. I'm going to consider this more like your 68 comeback special.
Well, there you go.
You're Elvis, okay?
There you go.
How about that?
Right. What about Willis Reed in Game 7 for the Knicks at the Garden, that's man? Just coming out.
That's a good one, too. Limping in.
There you go. Whatever it takes.
Scored some points, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we haven't done this in a little while, but from time to time, I like to watch music-related movies, and then talk about them, okay? Mm-hmm. So we're just going to do that today.
Cool.
All right. Now, these are both documentaries.
Okay.
And they are both on the Apple Plus TV or Apple TV Plus, whatever it is. So it's a subscription thing that
Apple
you can get.
Apple TV
streaming
Plus platform.
Service.
That's right.
There you go. Okay. The same thing that has Ted Lasso.
Okay.
You can watch these music documentaries on. So I want to.
Yeah.
I watched them both within the last week and a half or 2 weeks or so.
Great.
And we will discuss. So here's the deal. And these are both bands I think you really like. So
okay.
If you haven't if you haven't seen these, I think you will enjoy them. Okay, so the first one I'm going to start off with is called The Velvet Underground. That's just the name of the film, Velvet Underground. All right. So I think people have been trying or hoping for a Velvet Underground documentary or a good documentary for some time. Mm-hmm. This is brand new. It just came out just within the last, October 15th, it debuted on the Apple service.
Cool.
And it's directed by Todd Haynes, mm-hmm. who he was the guy who made that weird Dylan movie.
Which I love.
Remember that?
Yeah. I'm Not There, something like that.
Yes.
Great. But, with Jim James and Whiteface playing Dylan sort of as a Rolling Thunder review in that sort of pagoda, weirdly, with all those people walking around. It's so cool.
There were like several actors, right, who played Bob Dylan. I actually have not seen that, so I don't even know. So,
oh, it's great. So yeah, you got to see that, man. Oh, yeah.
He did that. He also did a fictional rock movie called Velvet Goldmine.
Uh-huh. I've seen that as well.
Velvet Goldmine.
That's right.
Weird Midwest accent, said it wrong. But
Christian Bale.
Right, which was sort of, I guess, based on like Bowie, right?
Iggy and Bowie. Yeah,
but it was fictional.
Took some liberties.
Yeah. So anyway, it was like a fictionalization of that glam era of the 70s, right? So anyway, so he's a filmmaker, obviously is connected with music or has a real passion for music, and also is a filmmaker who, you know, takes some chances, right, with the stuff that he does.
Sure.
This is a documentary, as I said, and I'm going to say this about it, and I've had a conversation with several people, some loyal listeners of the show who other listeners may know and respect and trust. Everyone sort of had the same opinion that it's a good documentary, but not a great one.
Okay.
And we also kind of think that there may not be a way to make a great Velvet Underground documentary, that it might just be an impossible task. So maybe this is about as good as it's going to get.
Yeah.
So here's the deal. It's very visually interesting. Okay. So for that reason alone, if you're a Velvet Underground fan, you should probably watch it, because, you know, earlier in their career, they had the benefit of working with Andy Warhol, who just like filmed a lot of stuff, and not so much just performance, but just like them, like at the factory. And, you know, a lot of some of them individually, like, you know, talking to the camera, some of them he just do like these test shots where they just sort of be in frame for long periods of time doing almost nothing, right? And so sometimes you just see that on the screen as you hear the voice of one of the members talking, and that's like all you're looking at is like the face of John Cale, right? And so
and it's so there's it's interesting too, Jim, to that point that, you know, Andy was back then in 65, 66, you know, 67 and all that. He was the guy that walks around now, you know, with his phone camera on all the time, taking video of stuff, right?
Or it was that, yeah.
Yeah, or in American Beauty, whatever that movie was, where the weird guy was walking around filming stuff all the time. You know, it was kind of that. And gosh, what an amazing trove, you know, of stuff Haynes must have had to look at.
That's exactly it. So he had access to all of this footage that's just kind of artsy and bizarre and weird. And that's kind of, like I said, it makes it a visually interesting movie, especially dealing with a band, you know, a 60s era band where maybe you wouldn't have a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
Because like you said, people didn't have this kind of equipment, you know, at the ready. So, so that's all good. I did learn, I would say being a fan of the Velvet Underground, and especially because they're a band that's so important for being influential, you tended as a music fan to learn about them because you were interested, like what made them so influential or made them so important. That if you have done that already, done that, put in that time and that work, there's not a lot of revelations in this movie because it basically is just sort of telling the story. There's not a lot of great insights or information that you probably haven't read somewhere, right? I would say there's a little bit, for me at least personally, I learned a little bit more about John Cale because because I think Lou Reed, having been through the band through its entirety of the, you know, the four albums that they put out at the time, and Lou Reed just sort of being a bigger than life figure later on and having a more successful career, I think I just knew more about Lou Reed.
Makes sense.
Maybe didn't know as much about John Cale. So I did learn a little more about his background and, you know, his being interested in, like, you know, like drone music and stuff like that, and how that sort of accidentally meshed very well with Lou Reed's more, you know, pop sensibilities, right? And that's kind of what, you know, I mean, it was kind of like the secret sauce that created at least the band, at least the first album, especially, right?
Yeah, the first two without a doubt. And Cale was Welsh, so that accounts for some of that. And, you know, obviously the world wasn't connected, you know, the way it was. But, you know, it's such an interesting point, and I do want to watch this because just sitting here, I'm looking at my bookshelf and I see five books on the Velvet Underground, and there's so much that has been written and so much that has been captured about this band, and yet we're so lucky and still, like you said, so fascinated. I mean, just listening to you talk, I want to go watch it right now because, and, you know, I eat up every morsel of whatever it is about this band. I always have. I don't know why, you know.
And that's the thing, is I would encourage everyone who's a fan to go watch this, but I would also say at the same time, I don't feel like you're going to leave it with anything new.
Right.
All that new or different than what you probably already know. That's probably my main takeaway.
Yeah.
And that, to me, just to take a step back here, is what I always wonder about music documentaries, is who do they consider the audience? Do they consider the audience to be fans of that artist, or do they consider it to be broader than that and potentially people who don't know anything about that artist? Right.
Right.
And that's, and think about that, that, especially for a band like this, that's two different approaches, right?
Completely different. Yeah.
Right. And so in this case, I think he tries to go somewhere in the middle. It's like some things the filmmaker doesn't really explain that much. It just assumes that you kind of know, for instance, about Andy Warhol. You kind of have to go into it knowing something about Andy Warhol being this bigger than life sort of, you know, pop artist in New York. There's not a lot of explanation on that.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to know that. I mean, they just start to talk about things like the factory and stuff like that without any real context for like what this is, right? But then at the same time, he tries to tell a very straightforward story about, mostly about Cale and Reed. You know, the others get their share of attention too, but not like, the, you know, those two guys, right? And
of course.
And in that case, like I said, it becomes a bit encyclopedic for a while, you know, just sort of explaining that.
Yeah.
So, now, I will say there's no narration to it, so everything getting is from the voice, because there are, you know, in Lou Reed's case, there's his voice from archival, you know, audio recordings, things like that. So you do hear from him. In the case of John Cale, you get new interviews, and Mo Tucker, new interviews, something like that. But anyway, so it's all well and good. I will also say a big complaint of a lot of people is that it focuses, almost the entire film is focused on the lead up to the first album and then the first and second albums, and it doesn't, it sort of leaves only a very little time at the end to hit up the two albums after John Cale out of the band.
Yeah.
And I think that was on purpose. I think it's really trying to tell the story of Reed and Cale. I think that's probably the main focus of the film, right?
Yeah.
And that attraction they had and sort of the tension that they had is probably one of the most interesting things about the band, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know? And as much as I love Loaded and think it's an amazing album, I'm not sure it's filled with a lot of mysteries that need to be... tapped into. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean, except for all the crap Blue said they erased and like he didn't play and Doug Yule put it on there or whatever. But other than that.
So I don't know.
It sounds like at least a worthy addition to the canon. I mean, I don't think somebody like Hainswright would, with the backing of Apple TV platform, you know, would make something that wouldn't be worthwhile. Obviously, had to have a lot of good research material and a good approach. So it sounds to me like it's, you know, the next good book that comes out and you get it, right?
Yeah,
and you read
That's exactly it. Now, I will tell you this. What really makes the movie, though, what's totally worth the price of admission for you, Patrick, and anyone else out there, I think any of our other listeners and people who just love music and the joy of music, I think, even so much, is toward the end of the movie, the second half, I think, you start to see Jonathan Richman on camera.
Yeah.
They did a new interview with him about his love of the Velvet Underground. And I didn't know that much about this.
I knew
he was influenced by the Velvet Underground. I guess I didn't quite realize how much he hung out with them.
Yep.
Because they played a lot of shows in Boston.
Yep.
It was one of the few places that would take them, I think. And they played a lot of shows in Boston. And he was young and he was just got super into this band. And he says he went to like 60 shows.
Yeah.
And
90% of their entire live performances.
You know, and he developed a relationship with them and all of that. And so beyond any of that, if he only went to one show,
yeah,
that would be fine. What makes it so appealing and so endearing and is his enthusiasm about this band just shoots out through the screen, man.
He just is
so in love with this music and it's so, the way he expresses it is so colorful and so genuine. And like I said, it speaks to that joy of music that we all have felt, whether it's this band or another band, you know, whatever it may be. Right.
Yeah.
Where you just get so into a band that you just can't stand it. Right. They're so great. And he still feels that way. Right. You can hear it, you know, and it's so wonderful that I almost was like, I could just watch 90 minutes of Jonathan Richman talking about the Velvet Underground. Right. That'd be awesome amazing. Film. Yeah. You know what I mean? So for that alone, it's really, it's just wonderful because, you know, at the very end of it, again, I don't know that you're really left with any better understanding of what made the band such a big deal. You know, that's the unfortunate thing.
Right.
But that may be an impossible thing to even explain. I don't even know, you know, like, I mean, we all have like our theories of what made Velvet Underground work and what made them such a big deal much later on. But it may be one of those things that it's cosmic in some sense. You know what I mean?
Like
can't even quite get into it. And I will say too, there's only a little bit of talk about their influence, you know, so, and to me, that seems like a much bigger piece of the puzzle here, but
yeah.
And there's a little bit about the context of the times too, which I felt could have been explored a little deeper as well. Like what made the Velvet Underground so different from other bands of the 60s? And, you know, you and I could probably, you know, have many episodes and talk about that and explore that, right? That subject by itself. And I think if you're a newbie, again, I'm not sure you're going to quite get it.
Yeah. Why were the Velvet Underground doing Black Angel's Death Song in the time of Sgt. Pepper and the Summer of Love, right?
Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
They were sort of a band out of time and place. And you get a little bit of that when they talk about going to California and how they couldn't stand it and how they didn't fit in and it just didn't work out and all that. But so you get there's a little taste of it there, but I could have used a little bit more establishing, like sort of like what was the music and culture of the time?
Yep.
And why were they taking the route that they took as opposed to, you know, if Lou Reed had this great talent as a pop songwriter and had that interest.
Yep.
Why did he take this route? Why did he write Heroin, for example? You know, like, why was he writing and playing music that at the time was just so out of touch with, you know, mass consumer culture, right?
Yep, totally, totally.
But then kind of wasn't, because if you listen to Velvet Ground, they do have a lot of really lovely, nice pop songs too. But what?
Right, right.
So, and like I said, it's kind of hard to explain this band. I don't even know how you do it. And that's probably why you have five books on it and you probably still don't fully understand them, right? Right,
totally. No, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And you know, to go back to the Jonathan Richman thing, I think it's the whole story of the Modern Lovers and John Cale, you know, producing their first album is so interesting, right? It's just an extension of that whole kind of conversation, which is just another amazing thing. So it sounds to me like definitely I got to watch it, at least for the Jonathan Richman stuff. Yeah,
totally. No, you should. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That for that. And then, you know, I think you'll enjoy it anyway. But
yeah.
But anyway,
one final question for you, though, Jim, is it all in black and white?
Oh, boy. It's mostly in black and white.
Okay. Okay.
I don't think it's all in black and white.
Okay, cool.
I was wondering.
Very interesting. Yeah. Somebody could make, you know, a documentary or even a, you know, a live movie recreation of any of the albums that the Velvet Underground made or any of those periods. And it'd be really fascinating, yeah, too. Yeah. So.
Myriad choices of the streets set themselves out upon a platform to choose. We're ready to lose. Whose bloody country all covered with sleep, where the black angel did weep, not an old city street in the east, gone in June. And Warren's brother walked on through the night with his hair in his face, by a long spent and cut from a knife of duty. The rally man's patter ran on through the dawn until we said so long to his skull. Shrill yell. Shining brightly red-rimmed and red-lined with the time of cruise, with the choice of the mine on ice skate, scraping chunks from the bills. Forgetting the pain, antiseptic remains, crew goodbye. So you fly to the cozy brown snow of the east. Gone and choose again.
All right, now let me move on to the other movie that I watched, also on Apple, that I enjoyed a lot. Okay?
Fight Club? Is it Fight Club?
It's not Fight Club. This one has actually been sitting on the service for a little while, and it's one of those deals where you have it in your queue and you, like, you know, finally get around to it, right? Because it came out in 2020.
Okay.
So, April 24th, 2020.
Good timing.
I just watched it. It's called Beastie Boys Story.
Oh, sweet.
And man, is it entertaining.
Oh, I bet.
Now, okay. Similar to Velvet Underground, I think this is a group that has had a lot of influence and done a lot of interesting things.
Absolutely.
But I also think their story is a little easier to tell. So,
yes.
So maybe that's part of it. Maybe it was just that. But I think the biggest thing, the thing that I enjoyed so much about this movie is that it's different from other music documentaries you're going to watch. And I thought in a good way. It's the two surviving members, Ad Rock and Mike D.
Right.
Telling the story of the Beastie Boys in their own words. On stage in front of an audience.
Oh, no way. That's cool.
So apparently, and I kind of think I sort of knew about this, but didn't pay much attention. I don't know why. But they did some kind of speaking tour right before the pandemic. Maybe 2019 or whatever, because they had vowed they would never perform again, as you know, after the death of Adam Yauch.
Right.
So what they did, they had written a book. The two of them had written a memoir, you know, about their Beastie Boys years. And then they sort of adapted that book into this like stage show speaking engagement thing. And they went on some kind of tour. And so this was the film version of one of those shows.
Oh, cool.
And it's produced and directed by Spike Jonze.
I've heard of him.
So it has, you know, so it's more, you know, so what could be kind of boring watching two guys talk on stage has a lot of, you know, style to it. So that's really cool. Right?
Yeah.
And it's funny and it's entertaining. And it's just like, you can tell what made them great. entertainers because they still have it, even though it's, you know, a little bit different form. They still have it. You know, they all the rhythms, just how they speak, how they interact. You know, it's obviously all scripted, but it comes off very natural. You know what I mean? So,
yeah, yeah.
They're pros. They're great at it. They've been doing it for years. They know how to do it. Right. So and then what I really loved about this was, again, you know, if you're a fan, you probably kind of know the story already about how they, you know, broke big in the 86 with, you know, Rick Rubin and Russell Simmons. And
yeah,
but they had this like, you know, crazy hyper frat boy, party boy sort of image and thing going on. And then they tried to follow that up with Paul's Boutique, which was super experimental, and it bombed. And by this point, they had already severed ties with Simmons and Rubin, and then sort of took, you know, stock in themselves, you know, and tried to mature a bit and became, you know, this really kind of very, you know, big 90s alternative act, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, so huge. So they go through all of that. But what's great about it, even if you sort of already know that, right, is that you're hearing it like in their own words, and they're telling their own, like their feelings, how they felt at the time or how they feel now looking back at all of that. And so it comes off as a very personal story, and it's really interesting in that way. And if you, and I also think this one works too if you're not a fan and you don't really know their stuff, because like I said, it's not a super complex story, so you can follow along with it, and it's really entertaining. And then there's like visual, it's not just them on the stage too, they have a, it's sort of multimedia, right? So you get clips of,
oh, I was gonna ask,
videos and performances, and you hear music, and
I was gonna
they
ask.
Do funny things with the video screen behind them, and,
oh, I bet, yeah, that's,
you know,
cool.
So
yeah,
and there's like props on the stage and all of this. It's like, you know, it's really well done and
cool.
And I think again that probably a lot of that has to do with Spike Jonze, and
right,
it's just really fun. It's a really fun movie, and why wouldn't you want a fun movie from a fun band like that?
Exactly.
Right?
So you sit back.
So there you
and,
go.
Yeah, and you watch that, and you probably pick up some stuff you didn't know along the way, which is great too. And did they do any actual rapping or singing?
No.
While they were okay, I was wondering.
No,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You get that from the clips they show.
I see.
You know,
cool. That's very
but
cool.
No, none of that in this. But and then I will also say too that when they talk about Adam Yauch and his death from cancer and so on, it gets really, you know, touching in that point. And here's a guy, I was talking with my wife later, because, you know, who died young, and but they really go deep in sort of like how he lived.
Yeah.
Which is more important, right? And this was a guy, he was like so driven and accomplished so much. I mean, he did all these amazing things.
Yeah.
He traveled the world and he did those, like, you know, Tibet benefit shows, and he met the Dalai Lama. He did all this stuff, right? He worked with, like, other bands, and he started
skiing all the time and stuff.
Yes. Yes.
Amazing. Stuff.
And it's sort of like, do you wonder, and again, I'm going to use the word cosmic again. Do you wonder in some kind of cosmic way, did he know?
Did he know
that time on this earth is short,
right. You
know, and that you got to live, right? Because, man,
very
he really did.
Mm-hmm.
He really did, right? And he seemed like he was just, you know, such a great spirit and a good a person who the other two, as talented as they may be, felt very fortunate that they worked with him.
Man. And I was lucky enough to be at that first Tibet concert that was held in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the spirit of that was great. And it just seemed like, wow, this is, you know, somebody taking a step beyond, you know, the concert for Bangladesh, but in the same spirit of it. Right. And trying to make it more conscious and eco-friendly and, you know, let's not think about borders. Let's think about all of us as people. And, yeah, he was an amazing guy. And I don't know, man, the Beasties always blew my mind because, like you said, like, here's a band that was like this, you know, if you're at a certain age, Jim, I don't know if you went through this, but at a certain point, like when I was hanging out, when License to Ill came out, it was like every party you went to, everybody's house, like somebody played that damn album at some point, you know, and you were like, cool, I like this album a lot, but it was like the party album. And you were like, these guys are kind of a joke. And then Paul's Boutique came out and it was so dense, and all of a sudden they were playing their instruments. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, these guys never, you know, they just wore like Adidas and ran around like they didn't, you know, and smoked a ton of bong hits. They never had musicianship. And then suddenly, you know, they're putting out these albums with instrumentals, and And just, right. you know, it's really incredible. And it sounds, I mean, like the Velvet Underground, like a hugely important American band that everyone should know about.
I totally agree. But, you know, like, as you see a lot in this film, and they have, you know, footage from back then too. I mean, they did start off as a punk band and they played, yeah, you
absolutely.
Know, yeah. you know, so they did have that foundation. So when they came around later and, you know, did a song like Sabotage, it seems totally natural, yeah. right? And normal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, totally. So. Yeah. And of course we didn't know that till later, right? Cause we right. never knew they were in a punk band until later, you know, when they started to get a lot more well-known and be taken a lot more seriously.
And I think that's what makes this so good too, is because they're very honest. You know, they
yeah.
to some extent, they try to distance themselves a bit from the License to Ill years, you
I'm
know,
sure.
like
yeah.
that's not how we want to be remembered.
Right. But they were you know? Kids, you know, they were kind
right.
of kids.
But they also
point.
Put
yeah.
it in perspective, right? Like that,
yeah,
totally. At that time, we were all in on that. Like,
right.
we're not going to lie to you now. Like,
that was like, our idea.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, like I said, I think they're very honest about it and just say, but
good.
At the same
yeah,
time,
yeah.
it's like, you know, later on, we wanted to mature and do something else. And
yeah.
and I think you have to salute them for doing that, because they could have absolutely been one album and done.
Oh, God, you yes. know? Yeah. They'd still be living off the royalties of that.
And we would just think of them, and we would just think of them as some novelty act.
Right.
You know,
right.
years later, right. not that important.
Ugly Kid but, Joe or something like that. Yeah.
But they did, you know, like I said, you know, kudos to them. They did some amazing work.
Yeah.
Later on and rebuilt themselves, rebuilt their career and became probably as big or bigger, you know, later on. So, yeah.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, super cool that they don't disown or, you know, try to, you know, say that was their manager or somebody who wanted them to
well,
know, act like that at the beginning of Rick Rubin or something like that. I think that's good. I mean, it is what it is. And there's a lot of people who've probably never heard License to Ill, you know, who have been influenced by the same sort of spirit that the Beastie Boys, you know, put on stage. So not only did they invent some great music, they invented a kind of persona and a
they
group.
Did.
Yeah, that's very important. Yeah.
But I don't know about you. You know, we both were of that sort of young, impressionable age when License to Ill came out. And so
yeah.
it was like, this is awesome. And then,
right.
you know, Paul's Boutique was sort of mind blowing. But I do think, you know, in the early 90s, when the post Nirvana age, when alternative music was becoming mainstream, right, or more accepted, that Check Your Head album just seemed really cool and really
yeah.
on point for that
yeah.
time, too. And you were like, you know, these guys get it, or they get where their audience is now.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they were trying to capture those people, or maybe they were just doing it because that's where they were, but it didn't matter because it worked out, you know. And but the point is, they weren't trying to go back and be like, let's
totally.
Appeal to the 16-year-olds for our whole lives. Like, that's was not
yeah.
what they wanted to do and would not have worked anyway.
And that's really well put, Jim. And I really want to watch this now just for this conversation. And plus how interesting it seems to see them do that. You know, I had no idea they were even doing that. You're right. I think they just, similar to what we were saying about how you get a sense, maybe cosmically, right, of something happening, they just followed where they were at that time, and whatever that muse was at that time, they chased that as hard as they possibly could. And that's what I love about them. So, yeah, it sounds like it's
great.
Worth a watch. Yeah.
I really liked it a lot. I thought it was,
yeah, very
it was really
cool.
great. So there you go. Beastie Boys Story and Velvet Underground. Those are your two
bands from New York City.
That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right. Okay, let's get out of here.
Cool.
We will. Oh, speaking of people who are sometimes maybe out of step with the times, but require your attention, we have a special
right.
guest tomorrow. All right.
Sweet. Yeah, man.
A caller. I'll just say that. Okay. All right, let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you tomorrow.
cosmically in tune.